He never raised his voice, never laid a hand on me, but he broke me all the same. This is the story of how love became a cage, and how I forgot the sound of my own name. He controlled what I wore when I slept, who I trusted, and I thanked him for it. He made me question my memories, rewrite my past, and shrink into a version of myself that only served him. But one night, while he slept too deeply, I remembered who I was. And I ran. This is the journey of how I escaped a velvet prison, piece by piece, and found the courage to say, "My name is Buttercup. I am not his, and I am free." Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you, Under His Spell. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1. The way he looked at me. I didn't fall for him. Not at first. I fell for the way he looked at me. Like I was something rare, something delicate, like he knew secrets about me I hadn't dared to say out loud. That look was the first spell he ever cast. And God, I wish I'd known then what I know now. I wish I could go back to that rainy Tuesday in October, to the little bookstore on Mercer and Fifth, where I was just a girl looking for an escape between the pages of someone else's life. The bell above the door jingled when I stepped inside, my hoodie soaked through, my hair a mess of damp curls I hadn't bothered to tame. I remember the warmth of the air, the scent of cedarwood candles burning near the register, and the faint classical music playing overhead. I remember thinking, this is the kind of place where people breathe easier. And for a moment I did, until I saw him. He was standing in the psychology aisle, one hand tracing the spines of books like he was reading them through his fingertips. He looked up when I walked by, just a glance at first, and then that second look. The one that lasted too long to be casual, too precise to be coincidence. His eyes didn't just meet mine. They searched me, like he was reading a page I didn't know was exposed. I should have walked away. I should have ignored the way my stomach fluttered, the way I suddenly became hyper-aware of how I stood, how I held my breath. But I smiled instead, and that was all it took. He approached me like we'd known each other in a past life, like this wasn't the first time our paths had crossed, just the first time we'd noticed. He said his name was Adrian. I said mine was Buttercup, and he laughed, not cruelly, but like he'd just heard the first note of a song he wanted to hear on repeat. He said it suited me, that I had an old soul and a soft heart, and that names like mine didn't just happen. They were given to people meant to be remembered. I laughed too. I let him walk with me through the aisles. I let him buy the same book I picked up, Wolves in the Skin of Men. I should have taken that title as a warning. Instead, I let him scribble his number on the back of a receipt and press it into my hand like a secret. That night, I reread the note 5 times. I don't know what I was looking for. A sign? A red flag? A reason not to text him? But the only thing I saw was the way he looked at me, like he saw someone worth unraveling. We started slowly, at least, that's how I remembered it. But now I look back and realize it wasn't slow at all. He called the next day, texted all night. By the weekend, we were drinking coffee in his apartment, and I was telling him about my childhood like I'd known him for years. There was something in his voice that made you want to confess. He made silence feel like a punishment, and I never wanted to disappoint him. He asked questions like a surgeon with a scalpel, precise, deep, quiet. Not the obvious kind either. He didn't ask what my favorite color was. He asked what kind of silence I liked, whether I preferred the ocean at night or the wind through pine trees, whether I felt safer in a crowd or in an empty room. He listened, really listened. His eyes never left mine, and every answer I gave seemed to unlock something in him. Like I was saying all the right things, passing all the invisible tests. At first, it was flattering. No one had ever studied me like that before. He'd memorized the things I liked, how I took my tea, the exact way I curled up when I read. He'd send me songs with lyrics that mirrored things I'd whispered to him in the dark. He'd show up with my favorite pastries, tell me I was beautiful in ways that didn't feel rehearsed, like he was discovering it for the first time every time he looked at me. He made me feel known. But being known is dangerous when the person knowing you is only pretending to care. The first time I felt off balance was barely a month in. We were at his place again, glass of wine in hand, music low, me curled up on his couch with my legs tucked beneath me. He told me I was too trusting. "People will hurt you," he said, brushing a curl away from my face. "They'll take everything if you let them." I asked if he would. He didn't answer. He just smiled and said, "I'm not like the others." I believed him, because I wanted to. That was the thing about Adrian. He never had to push. He just made you want to step closer. He drew you in with softness, with attention so precise it felt sacred. He didn't ask me to depend on him. He made me believe I already did. It was subtle, masterful, almost loving. When we went out, his hand was always at the small of my back. When someone looked at me too long, his eyes would flash with something fierce, possessive but tender. He said I made him protective, that he'd never met anyone like me. And when he kissed me, I didn't think about anything else. I forgot who I'd been before him. Forgot the girl who once dreamed of living in Paris, who had lists of books to read and countries to see. That girl quieted beneath his gaze. She wasn't needed anymore. He made me feel like I'd arrived. I didn't see the chains because they were wrapped in velvet. And so I stayed, even when he started suggesting I quit my job, that it was beneath me, that my boss didn't respect me, that my co-workers were jealous. Even when he told me my friends weren't real friends, because if they were, they'd see how good he was for me. Even when I felt a tremor in my chest I couldn't name. I stayed because love, real love, was supposed to challenge you. Right? At least, that's what he said. He said we were soulmates. That he'd never felt this way about anyone. That I made him better, made him whole. And I swallowed every word like honey, sweet, slow, and poison. I don't know the exact moment the spell took root. Maybe it was that first rainy day. Maybe it was the third time he touched my face like I was breakable. Or maybe it was when I stopped hearing my own voice over his. But I do know this. The way he looked at me, that was the beginning. And in the end, that look would become the very thing I had to unsee to save myself. Chapter 2. Little Promises, Quiet Control. I didn't realize I was giving pieces of myself away. Not at first. It felt like compromise. Like closeness. The kind of surrender you're told is healthy, necessary, noble. Everyone says relationships take work, that love is sacrifice. But no one warns you what it feels like when the sacrifice is never mutual. When your giving becomes his taking, and your boundaries dissolve beneath the weight of his affection. Adrian never yelled. He didn't need to. He didn't raise his hand or slam doors. His power lived in the quiet places. His tone, his timing, his ability to twist truth into a prettier shape and hand it back to me like a favor. He knew how to make himself the solution to a problem he created. He wrapped control in compliments and gave it to me as devotion. It started with little things, like my lipstick. "You don't need that shade," he said one morning, brushing his thumb across my bottom lip as I checked my reflection. "It hides your softness." I laughed, thinking he was just being sweet, that maybe he preferred something more natural. But the next time I wore it, he didn't kiss me. He just looked at me, cool, unreadable, and said, "That color makes you look different. Different. Not ugly. Not wrong. Just not the version of me he liked best." It was subtle, but I wiped it off anyway. Told myself it didn't matter. Told myself I didn't even like that shade that much. Next came the clothes. He loved when I wore dresses, flowy, feminine, soft-colored. The first time I wore black jeans and a vintage band tee, he tilted his head like he was seeing me for the first time and said, "I thought you liked looking like a woman, not a child playing rock star." I changed. Quickly. Quietly. I told myself it was just clothes. I still had a choice. But that was the trick. Adrian never demanded. He suggested. He implied. And I wanted his approval like oxygen. Then came my job. He never said I couldn't work. He just pointed out how stressed I was. How little they paid me. How my coworkers didn't value my ideas. "You're too talented to waste your time there," he said over dinner, feeding me roasted chicken and compliments. "You could do better. You deserve better." I agreed. How could I not? And when I mentioned a potential promotion, he didn't celebrate. He just narrowed his eyes and said, "Funny how they only see your worth when someone else starts to." I didn't take the promotion. 2 weeks later, I quit entirely. I told my friends it was mutual, that I wanted time to figure things out. I told myself the same thing. But in truth, I didn't recognize the decisions I was making anymore. They all bore his fingerprints, light enough to be deniable, deep enough to leave a mark. Adrian said I was finding myself. But every version of myself I found somehow looked more like the version he wanted. He started making plans for us, weekends away, curated dinners, silent retreats. He never asked what I wanted to do. He just told me what he knew I'd love. And when I didn't love it, when I voiced even the smallest hesitation, he'd say I was being ungrateful. Or tired. Or sensitive. "You always find a way to ruin things," he said once, after I asked if we could cancel a weekend at a remote cabin because I wasn't feeling well. "I do all of this for you. All of this. For me." The guilt sank in before I could even argue. I apologized. I packed the bag. I pretended it was romantic. That's what you do when someone convinces you that love is something you owe them in return for their effort. I started seeing my friends less. Not because he forbade it, he never did. He just dropped little comments, half-laughed suggestions that certain friends were too immature or bad influences. And I believed him. Or rather, I wanted to believe him. Because believing him meant believing we were special. That I'd found something deeper, something real. He always phrased it as protection. "You're too good for them," he whispered once, curling his arm around me in bed. "They don't get you like I do. You're different." I held that word, different, like a badge. He made me feel chosen, elevated, sacred. But sacred things are also kept separate, hidden, placed behind glass where no one can touch them. Before long, I stopped returning calls. I deleted messages without reading them. I convinced myself my friends had changed, that we'd outgrown each other, that maybe Adrian was right, and they never really saw me to begin with. But that wasn't true. He was the one who didn't see me, not really. He saw what he wanted. He saw potential, raw material to be molded. And I let him do it, because it felt like love. When we argued, it never sounded like yelling. It sounded like disappointment, like concern. He had a way of making me explain myself twice, three times, until I questioned the words coming out of my own mouth. Until I forgot why I was even upset in the first place. "You're so emotional," he'd say, shaking his head like he was disappointed in both of us. "I just want you to be happy." And then he'd hold me, like he was the victim, like he was the one hurting, because I couldn't get it right. I stopped trusting my instincts. I stopped trusting my own memories. I started rewriting things in my mind, adjusting the narrative so it matched his version. It was easier that way. Less painful. Less confusing. I told myself he was helping me grow, that I'd been naive before, that this was what adulthood looked like, messy, complicated, confusing love. But deep down in the soft, buried corners of my gut, something was trembling. It trembled when I sat in silence at dinner, afraid to mention my own thoughts because he'd find a way to twist them. It trembled when I laughed at his jokes that weren't funny, just sharp. It trembled when I caught my reflection in the mirror and barely recognized the eyes looking back. One night, as I sat on the edge of his bed, folding the laundry he said I was better at doing, I felt it, that tiny whisper of resistance. A flicker. A no. It didn't shout. It didn't scream. It simply stirred deep in my chest, asking, "When did I stop being me?" But before I could answer, Adrian walked into the room, kissed my cheek, and said, "See? You're getting the hang of it. Domesticity suits you." I smiled, but that whisper did not go quiet. And I knew, somewhere in the marrow of my bones, that love was not supposed to feel like a trap you walked into willingly. Chapter 3. When the Mirror Lied. I used to trust mirrors. The girl I once was believed in reflections. In her own perception. In the silent, steady truth of her senses. I used to think that if I saw something, if I remembered it, then it must be real. But Adrian taught me otherwise. He never said it outright. That's the brilliance of it. That's what makes it so damn hard to explain, even now. He didn't have to scream or accuse. He just planted little seeds of doubt, watered them with suggestion, and waited patiently for them to grow inside me. It started with a night like any other. We were lying on the couch, the movie playing in the background, some thriller with a forgettable plot. I wasn't really watching. I was scrolling through old photos on my phone, lost in memories. I found one of me and my best friend Evie, taken a few months before Adrian and I met. We were laughing, eyes crinkled mid-bite of pizza, tipsy on cheap wine and louder than we should have been. I smiled and tilted the screen toward him. "Look at this," I said softly. That night was so chaotic. "I miss her." Adrian glanced at the screen, then back at me. "You said she was toxic." My brows furrowed. "What? No, I didn't." "You told me she always made you feel small," he replied, shifting to sit up straighter. "You said she pressured you into doing things you didn't want to do." "No, I didn't," I insisted, frowning. "I never said that." "You don't remember?" His voice was calm, pitying. "We talked about it right after you quit your job. You said she made you question yourself. That she didn't support your decision." I blinked. Searched my mind. That conversation, it didn't sound familiar. But he said it with such certainty, such detail, that I hesitated. Maybe I had said something like that. Maybe it was just in passing. A moment of weakness. Event I didn't mean. "Maybe," I murmured. "I don't know." I was overwhelmed back then. He reached out and took my hand, gently squeezing it. "I just don't want you romanticizing people who hurt you. That's all. You've been doing so well. So much stronger lately. Stronger. That word again. He always used it when I bent to him. And in that moment, I believed him. I let the photo slide back into the gallery. I told myself memories were unreliable. That I'd misremembered, twisted the past through the lens of loneliness. But the mirror cracked that night. And in the weeks that followed, the cracks grew. They showed up in my conversations with him when I'd bring up something we did, a trip, a fight, a moment, and he'd tilt his head, eyes narrowed, and say, "That's not how it happened." He'd laugh sometimes, not unkindly, like I was being cute. "You're always so dramatic," he'd say, chuckling as if I'd just recounted a dream instead of a memory. "You add so much color to things. It's sweet." The first few times I laughed too. I assumed it was a difference in perspective. But then it kept happening, over and over. Until one night, we sat across from each other at the dinner table, and I brought up the time he surprised me with flowers and left a note on my pillow. The one that said, "You're everything they failed to see." His expression went blank. "I never wrote that," he said. I felt my heart hiccup. "Yes, you did. It was in blue ink. You tucked it under my pillow the night I cried after visiting my mom." He shook his head, brow furrowed in mild concern. "You're confusing it with something else." "No, I remember it." I was insistent now. Desperate. "I still have it. I think I saved it." He leaned forward, voice lower. "Buttercup, you've been overwhelmed lately. Maybe you imagined it." "Imagined it?" It was like ice water poured down my spine. The certainty in his voice, it made me doubt myself. It made me feel childish. Irrational. That night, I tore through drawers looking for the note. I knew it was real. I remembered the way the ink bled slightly at the edge. I remembered how the words made my throat close. But it was gone. Just gone. The memory remained, but the proof had vanished. I stared at myself in the mirror above our dresser that night, my reflection pale and worn, my eyes dull around the edges. I tilted my head, studied my own face, and wondered if I could trust it. Because if I couldn't trust my memories, if I couldn't trust my mind, then who was I, really? That was his magic. That was his method. He didn't steal my voice. He made me question whether I'd ever had one. He didn't erase my past. He just distorted it, one frame at a time, until I couldn't tell what was real and what was rewritten. He'd move things around the house, small items. My book would be on the floor instead of the nightstand. My shoes would be tucked in the closet when I swore I left them by the door. When I mentioned it, he'd smile and say, "You really need to get more sleep." And I did. I tried. But sleep became a battleground. I'd lie awake at night, staring at the ceiling, retracing memories in my mind like a forensic analyst. I wrote things down. I started keeping a notebook, small, leather-bound, hidden in the lining of an old purse I never used. I wrote down conversations, dates, things he said, things I felt. It became my Bible, my proof that I wasn't going insane. And yet, even as I read those entries back, I heard his voice in my head saying, "That's not what happened." I cried in the shower more often. I didn't want him to see. He said sadness made me less radiant. That my energy changed the whole apartment. That he could feel my moods, and they made him heavy. So I smiled more. I said, "You're right," even when I wasn't sure what he was right about. I stopped looking in the mirror altogether. Because every time I did, the girl staring back at me didn't look like someone I recognized. She looked hollow, softened around the edges. Too quiet. Too small. Adrian said I was evolving. But I wasn't. I was disappearing, piece by piece. And the worst part was, I still clung to him. I still wanted his approval, his warmth, his version of the truth, because it was easier than living in the chaos of not knowing what was real anymore. He made me feel safe inside the prison he built. He gave me certainty, even if it was a lie. And I needed something to hold on to, because the mirror was lying now. And I didn't know how to see myself without him. Chapter 4, The House with No Clocks. There was a time I measured my days in hours. I used to live by alarms, by reminders, by a steady rhythm of now and next. A life ruled by clocks, by coffee breaks and appointments, by the ping of a phone or the second tick of a wristwatch. I used to know where I stood in time. There was always a before, a during and after. But in Adrian's world, time stopped meaning anything at all. It didn't happen overnight. That's the thing about cages, they don't always come with bars. Sometimes they're built of velvet walls, of whispered routines, of slowly eroding choices. Sometimes you don't even realize you've been locked in until the windows stop opening and the sky looks different somehow. It started when I moved in with him. I told myself it was temporary, just for a few months. He said it would help us synchronize, help us build something real without all the outside noise. My lease was ending, and he offered before I even asked. Said it made sense. Said we were past the dating phase, and into something deeper. I agreed. I wanted to believe we were building something solid. I didn't notice, at first, that there were no clocks in the apartment. Not one on the walls. Not one on the microwave or the oven. The blinking numbers had been covered with electrical tape, black, seamless. When I asked why, he shrugged and said, "I like to be in the moment." I laughed. I thought it was quirky. But that was the first sign. The longer I stayed, the more I noticed the way time folded in on itself inside those walls. Mornings bled into afternoons, afternoons into evenings, and I could never tell what day it was unless I looked at my phone. And even then, Adrian would tease me. "Always needing to know the time," he'd say, stealing my phone and tossing it onto the couch. "You're addicted to control. You don't need to know everything all the time." He said it with a smile, but there was always an edge. He'd plan our days for me, waking me up at odd hours, sometimes just after sunrise, other times close to noon. There was no consistency. No rhythm. I stopped setting alarms because he said they disturbed his sleep. I stopped tracking my period. I stopped scheduling calls with my sister. The world outside his apartment began to blur, to fade like a photograph left too long in the sun. I didn't realize how much of myself was tethered to routine until it was stripped away. I'd stand in the kitchen sometimes, coffee in hand, staring at the window with no sense of how long I'd been standing there. Minutes. Hours. The light changed, but it felt unreal. Artificial. Like a set piece in a dream I wasn't fully awake for. He bought blackout curtains and said it was for my migraines. He moved my toothbrush from the left side of the sink to the right and told me it was more balanced. He stopped calling me Buttercup and started calling me Angel, Little One, his good girl. Those names clung to me like wet silk, soft but suffocating. I stopped correcting him. Stopped noticing when he replaced my old shirts with soft dresses, when my books began disappearing from the shelf one by one, when the apartment playlist shifted to ambient music and soft jazz. Nothing with lyrics. He said lyrics were too distracting. One day, I noticed a framed photo of us on the hallway wall that I didn't remember taking. I stared at it, unsettled. In it, I was smiling, my head on his shoulder, eyes closed. But something about the image felt wrong. Like I'd been mid-blink. Or mid-thought. I didn't remember that version of me. I asked him when it was taken. He said, "You don't remember?" That phrase again. I stopped asking questions after that. The isolation crept in slow, like fog. At first, it was just the two of us spending more time in. Adrian said the world was too loud, that we were more in tune when we stayed home. Then he started suggesting I take a break from social media. "You're always comparing yourself to others," he said, brushing my hair out of my face with such tenderness, I could almost ignore the way his words sliced beneath my skin. "You'll be happier without all that noise." I deleted my accounts. He told me to wait a few days before turning them back on. Then a week. Then I stopped thinking about them altogether. I stopped going out. He said the city was too harsh, too dirty, too unsafe. "You don't need anything out there," he whispered into my hair. "Everything you need is right here." And part of me believed him, because he was all I saw, all I heard, all I had. My phone would buzz from time to time, but I ignored it. If I picked it up too quickly, he'd get that look, blank, disapproving. Not angry. Just cold. Distant. That was worse than yelling. Silence was his sharpest weapon. He made me crave his warmth like a dog begs for scraps. One afternoon, I think it was a Tuesday, but I can't be sure, I found an old email from my friend, unopened and months old. She said she was worried. She said I hadn't answered in weeks. That I'd disappeared. I stared at the screen until my eyes blurred. When I looked up, Adrian was standing behind me. I didn't hear him come in. "You don't trust me," he said softly, not a question but a statement. "I know. I just..." He closed the laptop. "I open our home to you," he murmured, brushing his fingers over my jaw. "I share my world with you. And you still keep these little secrets." Tears welled up in my eyes, fast and hot. "I'm sorry." His thumb wiped the tear away before it could fall. "I'm not angry," he said. "I just want to know you're really here. With me. Not with them. Not with your past." "I am," I whispered. "Then prove it." So I did. I stopped checking email. I turned off the calendar app. I let him schedule everything, meals, sleep, even the days I could wash my hair. He said it was easier this way. That I'd thank him eventually. That women were more peaceful when they surrendered. And I was tired. So tired. My body began to ache in strange places, my back, my neck, my chest. like I was carrying something heavy I couldn't put down. I didn't tell him. I knew what he'd say. Mind over matter, Angel. You're stronger than that. I stopped bleeding. I don't know when exactly. But my cycle stopped, like my body had gone quiet too, waiting for permission to restart. Sometimes, I'd lie on the couch and stare at the ceiling, counting the breaths between Adrian's footsteps, waiting for the sound of his voice. Needing it to anchor me. Hating myself for needing it. The apartment was always quiet. Too quiet. No clocks. No buzzing. No laughter. Just the low hum of curated stillness. A house with no time. A life with no rhythm. A girl with no pulse. And still I stayed. Because leaving would mean waking up. And I wasn't ready for the pain that comes with knowing you've slept through your own life. Chapter 5. A voice not my own. It happened quietly. Not with a scream. Not with a slamming door or a confrontation. It happened in the silence between Adrian's footsteps. In the stillness after the lights went out. It happened when I looked in the mirror. Not for beauty, but for proof of existence. And saw something behind my eyes I hadn't seen in months. The flicker. A spark. Small. Faint. But real. I'd spent so long echoing his words, shaping myself to fit his image, that I forgot what it felt like to hear my own voice. But that day, it was raining again. I stood in the kitchen pouring tea into the mug he preferred, white ceramic, handle facing left. And something inside me whispered, "This isn't who I am." The words didn't belong to him. They were mine. And they terrified me. Because once you hear your own voice again, you can't unhear it. You can't go back to pretending you don't exist. But pretending, oh, pretending became my greatest weapon. I learned to wear my silence like armor, to shape my yes like daggers pointed inward. I smiled when he needed me to smile. I laughed on cue. I became the girl he built, the soft, pliable, radiant thing he believed he'd perfected. But behind my eyes, I was building something else. I was cataloging, observing, waiting. He never suspected, because men like Adrian believe control is permanent. They believe once they've broken something, it stays broken. He couldn't see that I hadn't shattered, I had folded, curled up tight, and waited for the storm to pass. The storm, it turned out, was him. The first crack in the foundation came with a voicemail. My old phone, buried in the bottom drawer of the hall cabinet, wrapped in a scarf and sealed with gilt. I hadn't touched it in months. But that day, while Adrian napped, I slipped it out, charged it in the bathroom, and turned the volume low. There were 39 missed calls. Most were from Evie. One was from my sister. One was from a number I didn't recognize, but it had a voicemail. Shaky, tearful. "Buttercup, I don't know if you'll hear this. I don't know if he's controlling you, or if you're just scared. But this isn't you. Please, remember who you were before. Remember that you laughed. Remember that you danced in the rain. That you loved old bookstores and ginger candy and terrible horror movies. If you hear this, please, just know that you are still in there. I believe in you. Come back." I played it twice, then a third time. Then I wept silently on the cold bathroom tile with the phone pressed to my chest, as if the voice could seep through my skin and reanimate the dead parts of me. I knew I had to be careful. I deleted the voicemail, hid the phone, left the charger where it had been. Adrian never noticed. His confidence was his blindness. He thought I was hollow. He thought I was his. That night, I cooked dinner without flinching when he corrected my technique. I told him the salmon was dry before he had a chance to. I smiled when he offered to fix my seasoning. I thanked him like a good girl. And inside, I took another note. He likes to feel smarter. Let him. I began writing again, just a little. Not in the notebook he'd find, but on slips of paper I hid behind the bathroom mirror, under the lining of the laundry basket, inside the hem of an old coat he hated. I wrote what I remembered. Who I was. What he did. I wrote reminders like, "You are not weak. Your memories are real. Love does not feel like a slow death." Each word was a matchstick, tiny sparks against the dark. One morning, while folding laundry, I found a shirt I hadn't seen in months, black, faded, with a vintage horror film logo printed across the chest. One I'd loved. One he had told me made me look childish. I held it for a long time. Then I put it on. When he saw me in it, he frowned. "I thought we donated that," he said. I shrugged. "I like it." His jaw tightened. But he didn't argue. Not openly. Instead, that evening, he played our usual playlist. Served wine. Lit candles. Kissed my wrist and said, "You've been so good lately." I let him think I was his doll again. But the doll had teeth now. I started reading when he was asleep. Late at night, under the covers, flashlight in hand like a child hiding a secret. I reread the books I'd loved before him. The Bell Jar, Rebecca, The Handmaid's Tale. Stories of women who'd been caged, erased, smothered, and who fought back. They became my religion. I memorized lines, whispered them into the dark. I turned them into incantations. And still I played the part. I cooked the meals he liked. I laughed at the shows he picked. I wore the soft dresses, but I kept the black shirt hidden under the bed, folded like a flag of rebellion. One day, while he was out for groceries, I found his locked drawer open. I don't know why. Maybe he'd grown careless. Maybe he believed I'd never dare snoop. Inside were notes, photos, a list of passwords, a folder labeled Buttercup. My heart stopped. I opened it. Inside were pages of observations, dates, moods, phrases I'd said. Like I was an experiment, a project. There were records of when I'd cried, how long I'd slept, what I ate. There was even a list titled, Triggers to Avoid, Use Only in Conflict. I nearly vomited, but I didn't scream. I didn't confront. I memorized everything I could. Then I closed the drawer and locked it again. That night, I kissed him deeper than usual. Let him think he'd won. Let him touch me like I was made of silk and silence. Let him monologue about alignment and spiritual harmony while my mind was plotting escape routes. I was no longer surviving. I was planning. Each word I said was calculated. Each breath I took was strategy. Because now I knew, he had documented me like an object. And objects can be moved. But people, real people, can run. The last piece came when I found my old ID in a coat pocket, tucked behind a receipt cracked down the middle. But there she was. Me. Buttercup. The real me. Hair wild. Eyes sharp. A little scared but unbroken. I stared at her for a long time. I'm coming back, I whispered. And for the first time in months, I believed myself. Chapter 6. The night he slept too deeply. It had to be a night he wouldn't remember. A night where his breath slowed into that deep, rhythmic tide. Long inhales, longer exhales. The way it did when he let himself trust me completely. He rarely did. But when he did, it was always after control. After I'd been obedient, affectionate, aligned, as he called it. That was the word he used when I didn't argue, when I mirrored his tone, wore the dress he laid out, and agreed with everything he said about the world, about people, about me. I gave him 3 days of perfect alignment. No questions. No phone glances. No sarcasm or hesitation. Just warmth. Soft words. The way he liked me best. And on the third night, he fell asleep fast, full of red wine and self-satisfaction. His hand rested lightly on my hip under the blankets. Possessive, even in sleep. But I waited. I counted the seconds between each breath. I watched his eyelids twitch in the near dark, moonlight spilling across his face like a ghost checking for signs of life. I waited until his grip went slack, until I could slide out from under his arm like silk slipping from skin. My body was humming, not with adrenaline yet, but with something colder, sharper. A low, relentless current of clarity. I moved barefoot across the room. My steps memorized. I'd practiced. Night after night in my head. Bathroom to bedroom. Drawer to coat rack. Phone to charger. I had traced it all in silence a million times. The apartment was pitch black except for the hallway light, which I'd dimmed earlier, just enough to see by. The curtains blocked out the street lamps, the moon. He liked it that way. Said natural light was too emotional. But I'd left the dimmer on low. A breadcrumb. My first stop, the bottom drawer of the hall cabinet. My old phone. Fully charged. Switched off. Wrapped in the scarf I'd hidden it in months ago. I slipped it into my coat pocket. Deep. Secure. Next, the folder. I had debated this part. Whether to take it. Whether to let it burn behind me. But something in me needed it. Not for revenge. Not even for proof. For memory. I needed to remember who I was. What he'd done. What I'd survived. I unlocked the drawer with the copy I'd made of his key. I'd formed it from clay, hardened it in secret, tested it on nights he left for errands. It clicked open with a soft metallic sigh. I froze. Waited. Listened. Nothing. Just his slow, even breath down the hallway. I took the folder. I didn't read it. Not this time. I already knew what was in it. His notes, his manipulation, his project titled Buttercup. He never saw me as a person. Just a subject. A puzzle to take apart and put back together in his own image. I shoved it into my bag beneath my notebook of counter notes. My real journal, the one filled with truth, stashed behind the bathroom mirror for months. I zipped it shut. Then the coat. It was old, thick, wool-lined. The one he said made me look too severe. Perfect. Shoes next, slip-ons. No buckles. No clicks. My heart was pounding now. Loud enough I was afraid he'd hear it. It echoed inside my chest like a war drum. Boom. 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 The hallway stretched in front of me, suddenly longer than I remembered. Each step like moving through water. Every floorboard a traitor. The silence was too loud, every creak a scream. I made it to the door. Paused. His keys. He kept them in the dish on the table by the front window. I crept over, lifted them slowly one link at a time. A metal whisper. Almost there. And then, a sound. A shift in the bed. I froze. My breath caught halfway out of my throat. I counted one, two, three. Then stillness. He just rolled over. Still sleeping. I moved to the door. Unlocked it as quietly as I could. I turned the knob. Opened it slowly, inch by inch, every part of me stretched thin and trembling. The hallway outside our apartment smelled different. Clean. Cold. Like freedom. I stepped into it and closed the door behind me with the gentlest click. And I ran. Not fast. Not yet. Just down the hall, quiet steps, controlled pace. But once I hit the stairwell, I ran. I didn't wait for the elevator. I took the stairs two at a time. My legs didn't feel like they belonged to me. They were lighter. Stronger. Like they'd been waiting for this. Down. 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 Past the floors that had once felt like prison bars. When I hit the lobby, I didn't look at the security camera. Didn't care. I pushed the glass door open and let the city air hit my face like baptism. Cold. Sharp. Alive. I didn't cry. Not yet. There were still pieces of the cage clinging to me. Still a part of me that half expected to hear his voice, to feel his hand grabbing my shoulder. But no one came. No one followed. I walked to the corner, where my old friend Evie had promised she'd wait every night for a week, just in case. And there she was, leaning against a rusted street lamp, arms crossed, face shadowed by the hood of her coat. She looked up, and her eyes, wide, wet, stunned, met mine. I hadn't seen her in almost a year. We didn't say anything at first. Then she whispered, "You did it." I nodded, and that's when I cried. Not pretty tears. Not gentle sobs. Wailing. Bent double on the sidewalk, my fingers digging into my knees, my throat torn open by the weight of all the silence I'd carried for so long. Evie wrapped her arms around me, and I collapsed into her, shaking so hard I thought my bones might shatter. "I couldn't leave," I sobbed. "I couldn't, he made me forget who I was." "But you remembered," she said. "You remembered. You got out." I don't remember much of the ride. Evie drove fast. The city lights blurred by. I kept checking the rearview mirror, expecting headlights. A black car. His silhouette. But there was nothing. Just night. Just wind. Just the hollow, aching sound of freedom. We drove for hours out of the city into the woods. She brought me to a cabin her aunt owned, empty, quiet, safe. No internet. No signals. Just trees and silence, and the slow process of coming back to myself. That night, I curled up under a thick blanket on a mattress that didn't smell like him. And for the first time in what felt like years, I slept. Really slept. No waiting. No listening for footsteps. Just darkness. And dreams that didn't belong to him. Chapter 7. I spoke my name aloud. I didn't speak my name aloud for 2 full days. Not because I forgot it, but because I was afraid of what it might sound like cracked and dust-covered after so many months of being silenced, shaped, softened into something that served someone else. Evie didn't push me. She brought me food I barely touched, wrapped me in silence instead of questions, and gave me a notebook on the third morning. On the cover in gold letters was the word, return. "Not answers," she said. "Just a place to remember." I held it like something sacred. For hours, I sat on the porch of the cabin, watching the fog roll over the tree line like ghosts exhaling. The world was quiet here, but not dead. Alive in its own rhythm. Wind in the leaves. Birds I couldn't name. The sound of my own breathing, shallow and uncertain. I didn't know what to write at first. But eventually, I picked up the pen and scribbled 3 words. "I am here." And then, "I am not his." And then, for the first time in what felt like years, I wrote my name. Not the pet names. Not the titles he gave me. Angel, little one, good girl. No. I wrote it clearly. Bold. Every letter with intention. Buttercup. And when I said it aloud, just once, whispering it into the wooden fog and wind, I felt something shift inside my ribs. Something loosen. Like my name had been buried in my chest this whole time, clawing to be spoken. I repeated it again. Louder. "My name is Buttercup." My voice cracked, but I didn't stop. I stood on the porch barefoot, shoulders trembling, and shouted it until the trees absorbed it, until the birds scattered, until my throat ached and my knees buckled. I sank to the ground with tears pouring from my eyes, not out of sadness, but out of release. It wasn't over. There was no neat bow at the end of trauma. No sudden transformation. Freedom isn't always a firework, it's often quiet. Brutal. Lonely. The air after escape feels heavier than you expect. Because no one tells you that even when you're safe, you're still haunted. The ghosts don't vanish the second the door locks behind you. They follow you into the quiet. They sleep under your skin. They whisper in your own voice. He did that to me. He didn't just steal my choices. He poisoned my memory of myself. He made me doubt my instincts, reshape my reflection, rewrite my history. There were mornings I woke in the cabin and still flinched at the sound of footsteps, only to realize they were mine. Healing wasn't pretty, or linear. Sometimes I missed him, not because I loved him, but because the version of me he constructed was simpler, smaller, easier to control. When you've been caged long enough, freedom can feel like chaos, like a storm without a center. Evie said that was normal. You were conditioned, she said one night when I woke up screaming. Of course you're disoriented. But disoriented isn't the same as broken. I clung to that. Disoriented isn't broken. I wrote it on the first page of my new notebook. Every time the shame returned, every time I heard his voice in my head, I repeated it like scripture. I read the folder. Eventually, the one I'd taken from his drawer. I sat on the floor of the cabin, cross-legged, and opened it like a time capsule. It was worse than I remembered. Notes in his handwriting, clinical, cold. Subject highly reactive to abandonment. Shows signs of early attachment trauma. Control must remain invisible. Direct assertion provokes retreat. Subtle reinforcement of dependence advised. There were logs of every argument, timestamps of my tears, quotes from things I barely remembered saying. I felt sick, violated, dissected, but I also felt vindicated, because I hadn't imagined it. The gaslighting, the memory tampering, the erasure. It was all calculated, designed. I wasn't crazy. I was conditioned, and I had escaped it. It was that night I decided to speak out. Not to him. He didn't deserve a confrontation. Closure is a myth people tell you, so they don't have to sit with ambiguity. There would be no reckoning scene, no screaming match, no final monologue. He wasn't the ending. I was. I started writing my story. Not as a letter. Not as a diary entry. But as a full record, truthful, ugly, detailed. I wrote about the velvet-trimmed chains. The love bombing. The days without clocks. The dissonance between affection and erasure. I named it plainly. Abuse. That word tasted strange in my mouth at first. But it was true. And truth, raw, red, unfiltered, was what would heal me. Weeks passed. I cut my hair. Not for a fresh start, but to remember my own hands had power. I dyed it a deep auburn, the opposite of the soft blonde he liked. I threw out every item of clothing he ever bought me. I kept the black horror film shirt, the one that survived. I wore it like armor. I reached out to Evie's therapist. I didn't want to at first. I didn't trust professionals anymore. Not after everything Adrian did under the guise of healing. But this one was different. She didn't ask me to explain right away. She just listened. She gave me words I didn't have before. Coercive control. Psychological warfare. Trauma bonding. And slowly, I began to build a new vocabulary. Not just to name what he did, but to name who I was becoming. I learned to cook again, on my terms. I learned to enjoy silence without fearing it. I learned that I didn't need to be soft to be loved. One morning, 2 months after I left, I got a message from an unknown number. I hope you're well. I forgive you. If you ever want to talk, I'm here. Hey! It took everything in me not to throw the phone against the wall. Instead, I deleted the message. Blocked the number. And then I whispered, I don't need your forgiveness. Because I had finally forgiven myself. For not seeing it sooner. For staying so long. For becoming so small. Forgiveness wasn't a pardon. It was an act of survival. That night, I walked into the woods behind the cabin, barefoot, under the moon. I looked up at the sky, breathed in the scent of pine and rain-soaked earth, and spoke aloud, once clearly, to no one and everyone at once. My name is Buttercup. I survived. And I am free. And the trees didn't answer. The night didn't erupt into applause. But the stillness that followed felt holy. Like the world had heard me. And finally, I had heard myself.